see ramen and try to put this on shell. But I think we have enough at this point that it's worth discussing what we have. I'm a particle theorist. Most of you are as well. So it perhaps should say something about why I got interested in thinking about De Sitter space. Just some of the broadest motivations is that even thinking about quantum field theory in De Sitter before getting into string theory or other attempts to really get directly at the quantum gravity, De Sitter just has some interesting properties that whatever eventual quantum gravitational description of the theory we have is going to have to wrestle with. First is that De Sitter, just like a black hole, contains a causal horizon. We now know that whenever you put a causal horizon together with a quantum field theory, you'll get temperatures, entropy, interesting thermodynamics. With a black hole, it's not so surprising that you have this finite entropy because black holes are these nice spatially compact objects. It's a little bizarre, a little more bizarre in the context of De Sitter to talk about a finite entropy. What exactly do we mean when we say we're counting some number of De Sitter microstates, De Sitter having infinitely sized spatial sections? That question is unclear. And unlike in the case of black holes, where people were able to go to very supersymmetric examples and in some nice cases, work out and identify what the degrees of freedom were and count them and show that it matched the more classical thermodynamic calculations. Just by virtue of being in De Sitter, the space-time is breaking supersymmetry. So we can't run quite that same playbook. Of course, the other reason to think about De Sitter is that it is a phenomenologically relevant theory. First of all, in the context of inflation, that was a period of the universe that was nearly De Sitter. The two-point functions that you get from De Sitter go like 1 over k cubed. This is the famous scale invariant spectra that the CMB almost realizes. Then, of course, our current universe is entering another era of accelerated expansion. So our future is also looking like a De Sitter universe. And if we want to understand how the cosmological constant could take this very special value, eternal inflation is one proposed mechanism that you have a landscape, and that eternal inflation is what allows you to sample the landscape and find an anthropically favorable vacua. If you want to say something more concrete, understanding eternal inflation also speaks toward understanding the physics of De Sitter. So here's the Penrose diagram for the space-time, where you can see a little more concretely some of the features I mentioned. Any given observer only has causal access to one of these triangles. So this is what gives the horizon that's giving rise to this De Sitter temperature. But if you want to, yeah.
Time's going
up. Time's going up, yeah. But if you wanted to think about, could there be some holographic description of the theory of De Sitter? The difference between the boundaries of the global space-time and the boundary that an individual observer sees slightly confuses how one should describe a boundary theory of De Sitter. Also, given that the also De Sitter has these space-like sections, so if the emergent dimension in De Sitter is time-like, while we now have many concrete examples of growing spatial dimensions, either ADS-CFT or even more sort of simpler ideas like deconstruction, maybe De Sitter is going to have to force us to understand how a time-like dimension could emerge from a theory without the presence of time. So these are some of the challenges involved in getting at a deeper understanding of the theory. And I won't, unfortunately, have anything too direct to say, but I'm going to talk about how our program might be able to give us some insight into what the dual description of De Sitter is going to be.
What do you mean by complementarity here?
Oh, well, that's just, there's this notion of black hole complementarity that you can either take you can either take the degrees of freedom inside or outside the horizon. They're equally good. There's a way to map between them. So maybe, you know, so maybe this extends to the sitter. You could talk about the global spacetime. You could talk about the causal patch seen by one observer. Maybe the information is all contained in one or the other. But I don't think, I mean, the moment, you know, we don't have a, you know, just a concrete, universally agreed dual description of the sitter. So these are still open questions. Okay. So, as I alluded to, there may be a dual description of the sitter, and given the great similarity between the sitter and anti-de sitter, maybe we can, you know, build it analogously to how ADS-CFT is realized. If you just look at the metrics, you see that they're quite similar, except that you'll notice that in de sitter, it's this the non-trivial dependence in the metric is in the time-like variable, whereas in ADS, it's coming from a spatial variable. De sitter contains in it a conformal group of isometries, but as I was saying, there are issues of you know, where you'd want to define such a dual theory to live. If you just try to take results from ADS, you see that you get the correlators you get correspond to the wrong ground state for de sitter. I'll have a bit more to say in a minute on how one selects the right ground state. You get complex anomalous dimensions. You're getting a non-unitary CFT. Maybe this speaks to the CFT not being the best language for the dual theory. Again, these are open questions in formulating the dual for de sitter. So we were sort of motivated to try to come at this from a more bottom-up perspective. Are there aspects of the theory in de sitter that could give us hints about, more physical hints about what the dual theory is, without just going, you know, taking some ADS results, doing some analytic continuations, and then seeing that one gets some physically challenging results. So, you know, the motivation that we came up with was, if you were trying to discover ADS-CFT for yourself, and you didn't have more brilliant people to give you an insight into it, one strong clue would be if you were, say, taking an RS-like theory, and you started playing with the geometry of the theory, experimenting with moving in maybe the UV brain. You want to change where it's localized. I mean, you would find, interestingly, that as you change the geometry of the theory, you were inducing a local renormalization of operators that lived on the brain. And so there is, you know, they're sitting in this, you know, rather straightforward field theory exercise, is this notion that that RG scale is dual to a geometric distance. And so, and this is special to ADS. If you tried to do the same thing in flat space, if I were to say, you know, take the position of that wall and I wanted to, you know, move it several feet forward in my theory, I would get, I would induce large non-local effects in order to keep the physics the same. The interesting thing about ADS is that everything can be phrased still in terms of local operators up to, you know, ADS curvature sized corrections. So that's holographic RG in ADS. So maybe we could try to find something similar sitting in de sitter as a way to try to attack the holographic dual. Now, as I showed you with the metrics, while the dual going between ADS and de sitter, the space-like radial direction in ADS maps to the time-like direction in de sitter. And so, you know, by understanding changing the geometry is corresponding to changing the location of space-like slices in time.
But this is very naive, but, you know, the usual arguments for, as you just said, that the reason why this sitter works is because moving this brain is not like changing the IR, it's really changing the UV.
Right.
Whereas if I change time, where time here is flat.
But as I move forward in time in de sitter, I'm going to the UV of the dual theory. So I am. It is motion toward the UV.
I guess it's not entirely obvious here why the time direction is maybe a few, or maybe a little bit too.
I mean, it's the time-like direction is the analog because, I mean, again, this is just coming from the from the metric that if you were to map, if you were to map ADS to the sitter, you would be sending this space-like coordinate to that time-like coordinate. So it's, again, it's this non-trivial radial direction in ADS that maps to the time-like direction in the sitter. So,
are you proposing to sort of regulate both the, like, are you, I mean, I guess it's not clear, as, and maybe I'll get to this, is where there's an analog of the two brains.
Right.
Do you really need both brains for this picture to work?
So the, I mean, the interesting thing about the sitter, as you'll see, is that the, so there sort of is a sense in which you do need to regulate the IR, which I'll get into, but the, the de Sitter theory is essentially going to erase all memory of any details of its past. And so to take, in this dual language, it's as if, you know, you can start the theory wherever, and then the renormalization group is going to flow you to some attractor. And so given that you've, given that it's an attractor solution, your sensitivity to what was put down in the past or in the IR goes away.
So I should think of the past as the IR and the present as the UV, or the future?
The future is the UV.
Okay.
So so we're looking for an RG-like behavior that has something to do with the time-like direction of the theory. And already sitting in the language of de Sitter was this notion of stochastic inflation, which is going to be the subject of the rest of this talk. And I'll explain why something written down in 1986, long before people were thinking seriously about holography and dual theories, is nonetheless an interesting place to try to sniff out information on the dual of de Sitter. Okay.
So you're saying, if this is true, I mean, the whole notion of causality is put on its head, right? That somehow our future is actually determining this entire universe, right? Because your theory is defined in the future.
Well, I mean, I don't need past propagating degrees of freedom. I'm just saying.
No, you don't need past, but all your data is defined in the future. Because the IR data is erased.
Right.
So.
Yeah, I mean, your. What am I saying? You know, de Sitter is this sort of, as I'll get into, de Sitter has this sort of prodigious production of particles, and so it's something like a thermal theory, that it sort of doesn't matter what you do, the theory is going to, you know, pump the system full of extra particles, and it's just going to take it to some particular future state, which is just determined by very simple properties of the theory, like the potential that your modes are interacting in. If you could say that that's acausal.
I don't want to use the word acausal, but
yeah.
It just means that the data that you need to specify is somewhere in the future.
Well, it's, I mean, you can specify the data now. There's a minimum amount of data that once you specify now, that's all the theory cares about. And for the, as I'll show, for the case of scalars, it's just the potential. And the form of the potential dictates the asymptotic form of the theory. So that is something that you can determine now with local physics. But it turns out that all these other details get washed away. So.
Are you talking about de Sitter like or just real de Sitter?
I'm talking about pure de Sitter.
Okay, so in de Sitter, that's a very slicing dependent situation, right? You go to the static patch and say there's nothing terribly dramatic going on. So.
I'm sorry, I missed the.
So we could go to, in pure de Sitter at least, we can go to a static patch and mm-hmm. there's a time translation to the tree and patch, there's nothing dramatic going on.
Right. But that is just a statement of the static patch.
Sure.
Right. So I want to take I want to take an FRW slicing, which is going to get me the entire future. I'm going to be able to say things on the entire future space-like surface of De Sitter. So, right, I am in this discussion that I was mentioning earlier about where do we want to define the boundary of the theory. I am proposing that I want to talk about things at the future, at I plus, the future space-like boundary of De Sitter. So that's a choice, and I'm just going to say there are interesting things that we can observe if we make this choice, which is certainly different from what would be seen by a causal patch observer.
Yeah, no, I was saying at least in De Sitter, I don't know about generically, the naive thing that gets washed out, I think, might be a little dangerous. It might be, certainly locally, you know, if you cover everything you want to cover, if you look carefully enough, it won't be obvious.
Right.
I think you should keep going.
Yeah. Okay. So, what is stochastic inflation? So I'm going to go into a lot more detail on this, but just to sketch it broadly, if you have a light scalar in De Sitter, we will see that perturbation theory is going to break down. You will be unable to do perturbative quantum field theory. So Arvinsky realized that even though perturbation theory is breaking down, you can convert your De Sitter field theory into a theory of classical statistical mechanics. And then, given this StatMech system, you can then do the same sort of computations you would do in a QFT, you know, endpoint functions. And so just as an example of why one might put any stock in this formalism is that if you go to a sort of intermediate regime where you can still work in perturbation theory, but you are also still in Starobinsky's classical regime, you can compute endpoint functions, and you see things like this, you know, very non-trivial two-loop contribution to an endpoint function is found by this stochastic inflation framework. So it's just a sort of fixed order check, but it's a very non-trivial check that stochastic inflation passes. And so to me, that was enough. That was enough to at least take it seriously and to try to understand how one can set that up without sort of mapping it to a different type of theory, but just within the quantum field theory, how this is realized. Okay, so that's our main goal, is just getting stochastic inflation within quantum field theory. Okay, so since not everyone here may be familiar with the basics of De Sitter, just to quickly go over it. De Sitter is usually pictured as a hyperboloid living in one extra dimension for a d-dimensional De Sitter. And there are various coordinatizations of it, and the one we'll typically be choosing is this FRW-like coordinate, which has the nice feature that spatial slices are flat, and it can be just conformally related to the usual flat space-time metric. One gets this conformal time variable, which we'll be using a lot, and the thing to note about it is that it goes from minus infinity to zero. Okay, so it's always negative, and future infinity is 80 equals zero. As an FRW theory, the scale of De Sitter is this exponential. And then one goes back and forth between the co-moving coordinates that one sees in this metric and physical coordinates. Again, if the space-time is exponentially expanding, of course, the physical separation between two co-moving points is going to expand exponentially, and if I put down any wave, it's going to redshift exponentially, and so physical momenta are going to get perpetually softer. So that's the geometry of the space-time. We, of course, want to do quantum field theory in it, and I'm just going to be talking today about scalars. So here's the action for a scalar in De Sitter. Now, usually in a flat space theory, once we have the action, you know, we're ready to go and compute. There's an additional non-triviality in De Sitter, and that we need to define what state we are computing with respect to. One sort of unfortunate feature of the space-time is that there's no global time-like killing vector. One can define it in the static patch, but not over the whole space-time. And so what one means by things like ground state energy, that's no longer it's no longer as sharp a statement. And furthermore, as the space-time expands, it's going to create particles. So we don't even have this notion of, the vacuum is a state which I can just say is completely empty, because any state that I give you is going to get populated with particles over time. And so it doesn't remain the vacuum. But there is a standard choice. When you solve for the field equations in De Sitter, you get there sort of two different Hankel function solutions. And the standard ground state sets one of these to zero, and it's chosen to make your state De Sitter invariant. And as you flow into the infinite past, which you can think of as as you flow to the infinite past, everything is blue shifting because everything is shrinking, sort of going back to a flat space like limit, because every mode is very short wavelength. This choice of state is minimizing the energy, and you also see that if you were to count particle number, that particle number is going to zero in the infinite past. And so that's why that choice is made. It's also this mode function goes over to being positive frequency in the infinite past, and so it really has a sort of flat space-like limit as you take everything to very short distance. There are, these are sort of nice features. You might ask, how crucial they are. So there's this interesting set of states that if you take non-zero values of B, they're called alpha vacua. It's a whole interesting other subject. But the evidence at the moment shows that they have sort of more distinctly pathological properties like acausality. So we won't have anything more to say about alpha vacua today. Okay. So I mentioned really early on in the talk that one of the reasons why De Sitter is interesting is inflation, that we observe this nearly 1 over k cubed correlation in the sky, and that's a great triumph for that theory. But in terms of the formal field theory of a pure De Sitter spacetime, that 1 over k cubed actually gives us trouble. If we were to ask not for a momentum space correlator but a position space correlator, we would see that we would get this sort of dk over k integral, and so it's doubly divergent. Of course, nobody's afraid of UV divergences in field theory anymore, but this IR divergence is something that we have to treat if we want to just compute in the theory. Okay, so. Now, the IR divergence, is a problem for us, but if we thought about things more physically, it's maybe not surprising. If we're saying we have a pure De Sitter spacetime, then that means that it's run, even into the infinite past. And so, and if we go to the limit where the theory is massless, we're saying we've let a spacetime, that can create that create particles as expands, run for an infinite amount of time, and we're going to count them all the way down to the, all the way down to k equals zero. And so, maybe it's not surprising that in doing that counting with an infinite input, we get out an infinite answer. And so, if you just ask about particle creation in De Sitter and take, say, the energy uncertainty relation and ask about, well, what is it, Can we fluctuate, say, two quanta with energy E, and in the limit that the theory is massless, you see that if the physical momentum is less than Hubble, then the energy time uncertainty relation is always satisfied, so you can create particles and they persist. And so this is one demonstration of the fact that De Sitter creates on-shell particles, and they can hang around for the rest of the spacetime. Now, the reason that I'm talking about scalar field theory, which is not usually, we don't usually go to phi to the 4 theory to try to get insights into quantum gravity, but it's only the scalar that has this interesting pathology. If you were to take a fermionic theory or a vector theory or even the conformal scalar theory where the scalar then has a non-trivial coupling to the Ricci tensor, you see that that theory is conformally related to the flat space theory as you take the mass to zero. And so yes, you can produce fermions and vector particles, and they will persist. Nothing about this relation assumed anything about the spin of the state. But the rate is very suppressed because of this conformal relation. It gets suppressed by 1 over the scale factor, and the scale factor is growing exponentially. And so this 1 over k cubed IR pathology is unique to minimally coupled massless scalars. Okay. So to compute it, we're going to have...
So is it just because the graviton has to couple with the derivative to the other ones?
The graviton...
Why is it that the rate is suppressed?
I would say that they, because when you take this limit, you just recover the flat space metric. Whatever rate they have to fluctuate would have to fluctuate in a flat space time is getting suppressed because they of course you're seeing the they think they live in a flat space theory given by the conformal time. The coordinate time is this t, and there's a relation between the conformal and the coordinate time that suppresses this rate exponentially.
Right, so what's different with scalars?
Sorry?
What is the difference with scalars?
Oh, in the limit that you take m to zero, you don't just recover some overall factor on the flat space action. So you can't just say that, as far as the scalar knows, it's in some flat space time with a different, with just a different time.
But is there any qualitative difference that you can see directly in the distitter? This is a somewhat formal justification, right? Because you're relating it to another theory.
Yeah.
But there should be some difference associated with it even directly in distitter.
Yeah, no, I don't. Yeah, I. Other than you compute these correlators and they don't have the IR divergence for these other spins, I don't know a more direct way to see it. Gravitons are an interesting case because there are competing claims in the literature about whether or not they have the IR pathology. But the more recent evidence, again, I think for things like their extra derivative couplings involved with gravitons, it seems unlikely at this point that they have the same pathology as the scalars as well. But it isn't this simple conformal, massless conformal argument.
For both vectors and fermions, it's just 1 over A. No, like the same power there.
Yeah.
Particular polarization of graviton fluctuations behave exactly like massless minimal coupled scalar?
Right, so this was the argument that people have given for why the graviton might also have this pathology.
But at least, you know, on the level of effective field theories, there is no difference. The ones that I will describe for those particular polarizations of graviton look exactly like a massless minimal coupled scalar. So I guess I am confused, like probably other people. That argument 1 over A, and why is that argument somehow magically does not apply to a scalar field? I just don't see that.
Again,
I mean,
you don't.
If it's not a big deal, you know,
yeah,
you
yeah.
should go ahead.
I mean, I'm just saying that you don't. If you take the mass of a scalar to zero, you don't just get some overall factor times a flat space theory and a conformal.
But I just gave you an example.
Well, no, you gave me the example of a graviton,
yeah,
which is
exactly the
but
same.
But this,
yeah.
I'm not claiming anything about the graviton because I would say that's an unsettled question, whether or not the graviton has the pathology.
Yeah, No, but I'm talking about particular polarization of gravitons that would decouple from the rest, right? So I'm talking about, you know, velocity field fluctuation. So, but anyway, it doesn't
yeah.
It's,
so again, I was trying to avoid gravitons entirely. But this is why we're talking about scalars and not fermions and not some quasi supersymmetric theory with you know, with many examples of each field. Is why I want to claim there's something specifically interesting about the massless scalar. That was the only statement I was trying to make, and maybe there is something interesting about the graviton as well. So to proceed, I have to get around this IR divergence somehow, just to even define a space position space correlation function in my theory. So I'm going to go back to the assumptions I made when I defined the state that I was going to compute with respect to. And so you remember that one of my conditions was that I wanted my state to be De Sitter invariant. So that seems like the sort of least troubling of the assumptions to break. Remember, the other ones had to do with you asymptote to a ground state, or you asymptote to a minimum energy in the past, you asymptote to an empty vacuum in the past, saying that things, you know, really look like flat space as you go to really short distances. Those assumptions I'm going to keep intact.
I'm very confused about your purple. You keep saying it's the past, but then you're saying it's the limit in the UV.
So you have to. Right, this is the. There's a difference between so any individual mode, it unambiguously red or blue shifts.
It means that when I go to the IR, things get blue shifted, and that's what you call them in the UV.
Right.
Okay.
There's what's seen by an individual mode, and then there's the normalization group flow of the dual theory,
mm-hmm.
and sort of confusingly they go oppositely. So what I was saying was that as the modes themselves go to arbitrarily short distances, we want to keep those assumptions which held that they see a theory which looks like Minkowski space. But there was a third assumption I made, which was that the state had to be De Sitter invariant. And so that's the one I'm going to break. If you remember, I wrote my mode solution in terms of two Hankel functions. So De Sitter invariance was the statement. Part of it was the statement that these A and B were K independent. So I'm going to break it by introducing a very mild K dependence. So unfortunately, the A and B are the alpha and beta on this slide. So all I need to regulate the theory in the IR is just have, when one computes this two-point function, you wind up with this combination of the mode functions. And you just need some infinitesimal amount of K in the IR, and that will regulate this theory. So an example state that one could take is something that looks like this. It's an exponential of the square of a creation operator. So you see that in the limit that beta goes to zero, which was the Bunch-Davies limit, you just recover Bunch-Davies with the state, but you populate it in the IR. Again, in the UV, these A and B, they're going to look, B is going to go to, beta is going to go to zero, alpha is going to go to one, you're going to recover Bunch-Davies. So again, in the UV, where it was important for us to be in Bunch-Davies to recover flat space, this state will have that property as well. Okay. So that's a very sort of formal regulation of the infrared. Let me give you a more physical picture of the sort of theory I'm considering. So if I, essentially what I'm saying is that, I'd run this De Sitter space for an infinite amount of time by saying that I was in pure De Sitter. So let me just regulate the past by saying that at some point, De Sitter began. Okay. So if I had been in some other cosmology before that, say maybe an FRW universe, okay, there are no IR issues in FR in just like a radiation FRW universe, matter FRW. And in such a universe, the co-moving horizon will grow with time. Okay. So let me say that at some point, inflation started. I transitioned from some slow growth universe to the rapid exponential growth of De Sitter. In De Sitter, the co-moving horizon actually shrinks. So we can think about what this means for the softest modes in the theory. So these wavy lines are meant to be fluctuations. So at some very long wavelength, there are some modes that never made it inside the horizon of the old slow-growing universe. And so when the transition to De Sitter occurs, they're outside the horizon for the rest of the growth of the De Sitter. Once a mode is outside the horizon in De Sitter, it freezes at whatever value it's taken. Okay? So there are no IR issues in this theory. Now we're saying that we have modes frozen at their IR safe values in De Sitter. And so in this way, we've regulated the infrared. So just by saying that De Sitter has started at a finite time. So, you know, again, formally one can get this alpha and beta by matching to some alternative cosmology at the time of the start of inflation. And one sees that they recover this structure. But I think more physically, you can just think that we're regulating the IR of De Sitter by saying that De Sitter had a definite start time. Ethan.
Feel free to ignore this, but I don't understand how beta, how this regulates it. When beta goes to zero, the integral is still diverged.
It's like a photon mask, right? I mean, so this is just a regulator.
Okay, at some point you're also renormalizing.
No, I don't. This is an infrared regulator. I'm changing the theory. So I'm saying that I don't have an infinite De Sitter.
Okay.
I'm saying that
you'll never take beta to zero.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Now, what I will show is that all of the details of what this regulation was, you know, get wiped out by the De Sitter. So that in some very formal sense in the infinite future, I can't take it to zero because there's just no dependence on it whatsoever. But you shouldn't think of it as a sort of formal regulator that I'm going to take away. I really am changing the cosmological history to something like this, where De Sitter started at a finite time.
So you should be worried about UD now once you turn on beta. So I know that you turned on betas in order to...
But beta goes to... This statement only holds in the IR. This beta is going to shut off in the UV. So for large enough K, this is zero. So it doesn't give me any
but
extra.
Your theory is free, right? You're looking at the free theory, right?
For
so
now, this is a free theory.
And extend it from K, an integral from zero to infinity, right?
Right.
So if you're changing this, you're saying that's not going to be a problem.
No. In the UV, these alpha and beta go exactly to their bunch Davies values. So you get no extra UV pathology by having modified them in the IR.
You just by hand prescribe the state in such a way that it's...
Exactly. So again, this is formally the behavior they need to have, and of course you need to make sure that the K dependence in the UV doesn't give you extra UV problems, but you can write down such a function. And if you wanted to be super explicit, you could even, you know, posit, say we were in a radiation FRW universe and then at T equals whatever we became a De Sitter theory, and then you could, you know, literally compute what the alpha and beta that you get are. Okay. So now that I've regulated my theory, I can write down a position space two-point function. And in the massless case, I get this form. There's this sort of very familiar curved space-time-like part. And then there's the part that's sensitive to the fact that I've regulated in the IR. Now, what's interesting is that this expression holds for x and y being co-moving. Those are generally easier coordinates to work with because they don't have extra time dependence. But if we put in, you know, if we wanted to ask, well, what's the two-point function of two space-time points that are at a fixed physical separation? I don't know, two detectors connected by a steel rod. You would see that when you put the scale factor into this co-moving R here, you get a two-point function which is going to grow with time. And so this is the interesting statement. You've said that effectively we're saying De Sitter is starting at a finite time. And now the theory sort of knows that it started at a finite time, and it's counting the variance of the field is going to grow linearly with time. you know, one way to think about this is the theory of sort of executing a random walk based on this time, that sort of every inverse Hubble, the theory fluctuates by some Hubble amount. This is the sort of diffusion you would get from having a Hubble length, Hubble scale random walk. So now, everything that I talked about up to now has been a free theory, but of course, we want to work with interactions. So for concreteness, I'm going to be talking almost entirely about a phi to the fourth theory. But you see that no matter how small I make my lambda, because my two-point function in this regulated de Sitter is going linearly with time, every propagator I get, if I wait long enough, is going to be dominated by its linear in time part. And so no matter how small I make this lambda, eventually I can wait long enough and all these factors of time are going to overwhelm it. Okay. So this is the breakdown of perturbation theory for a massless scalar and de Sitter. And the question is, you know, can we compute anything now that we have to abandon perturbation theory? Okay. And so this was Sarabinsky's physical insight. The IR of this sector is what's given us all the trouble. It's why we had to get into this whole discussion about regulating the theory. It's what forced us to bring in these correlators that go linearly with time. Okay. But interestingly, while the IR causes a problem, it also gives you a way out. And you know, what we'll show is that the infrared portion of de Sitter, while it's no longer treatable as a perturbative quantum field theory, one can see that one only needs to understand the classical evolution of the theory in this limit. The IR of the theory is classicalizing in a way that I hope I can quantify for you. Okay. So we don't have to do a non-perturbative quantum field theory. We now only have to do a non-perturbative classical theory. And I'll explain to you, and our non-perturbative classical theories, of course, are challenging in their own right, but I'll explain to you why that nonetheless makes it tractable. Okay. And I'll just, you know, again, I'll just point out that, you know, this was a brilliant physical insight, but it sort of wasn't entirely describable in terms of quantum field theory. He had to promote or convert statistical mechanics, quantum field theory, creation annihilation operators into being stochastic classical noise sources in a stat-mech theory. We want to say everything just in terms of quantum field theory, and wave functionals are going to be what allows us to make that statement. Okay. So let me first, you know, the most crucial observation is this notion that we have a theory that's classical in the IR. Okay. So let me attempt to justify that for you. So for us, because wave functionals are the formal tool that we're going to use to analyze the theory. And so classical for us means something very concrete. There are, of course, many different ways that you can describe semi-classicality. But for us, it's going to be the statement that we can evolve the wave functional using the WK-Breer approximation, which is equivalent to the stationary phase approximation, okay, which is to say that as we evolve things of this form, we can insert the classical action as we evolve them. Okay. Now, in the limit of a free theory, of course, we can just compute everything. So we have the exact answer. This is the exact wave functional for Bunch Davies up to a field-independent normalization. We can also compute the evolution of the Bunch Davies wave functional in the stationary phase approximation. Okay. So you know, here is how you would evolve a wave functional in the path integral formalism, okay, and we're saying that we're going to approximate it by just taking the classical action for the field between these points, and start with the initial wave function that has the field values dictated by the classical action reaching whatever final value for the field we've ascribed. Okay, so that's something that we can just compute, and you see that. The semi-classically evolved wave functional compared to the full wave functional agrees up to some you know, very small correction if we're taking k to be small. So again, we're in the IR, so we're taking k to be small, and we're interested in late times, so we're taking eta to also be small. Remember, infinite future is eta equals zero. And so you see that, you know, you can evolve the theory fully up to some eta naught, and as long as the k's you're interested in are not too large, and you waited long enough with eta naught, you can recapture the dominant behavior of the wave functional with the WKB approximation. Okay, so now, of course, we're not just doing free field theory, we're doing a non-perturbatively interacting field theory. Okay, so let me try to use the same WKB intuition, but in the presence of a non-perturbative interaction. Okay, and just for concreteness, I'm going to take a phi to the 4 theory. Now, since I'm in the IR, all of my gradient terms are going to be very suppressed. Okay, the k physical squared is dropping out of the theory. And so I can map the theory, if I'm careful, again, because the spatial dependence is dropping out, I can map my field equation into a 1D system, because again, I'm decoupling spatial dependence. So now let me ask about the WKB approximation for an anharmonic quantum oscillator. Okay. Now, when does the WKB approximation hold? It holds if the de Broglie wavelength of my field, if I can fit many, many, many of them into the turning point for this anharmonic orbit. What that corresponds to is, that means that the turning point, putting in the de Broglie wavelength, that means I need to have a turning point with this dependence, okay? Which is to say that I need my turning point to be much larger than this funny factor. But you'll notice that crucially, there's an eta here, and eta is shrinking exponentially with time. So the more that time progresses, the more and more de Broglie wavelengths I can fit within an orbit. Okay. So going back to the field theory, let me take the following assumption. I have modes that cross the horizon. They become infrared. Let me assume that after one Hubble time from crossing the horizon, they become very non-perturbatively sensitive to the presence of the potential, and they all fell down to the origin, which is the worst place that we could be from the point of view of the WKB approximation. Okay. So even under those radical assumptions, I see that, again, an exponentially decaying part of the state with time is lying outside of the regime of validity for WKB. Okay. So this is to say that the support of this state is dominated by regimes where the WKB approximation holds. So we're going to take that as the ability to do stationary phase evolution of the wave functional. Okay. Now, again, I said even if our theory is classical, still non-perturbative classical field theory is challenging, and so we're going to need some additional approximations to get a tractable result. Okay. So again, one of the further approximations we can make is that since it's the IR of the theory that's giving us all the trouble, let me take the approximation that the UV, I can still do perturbation theory in the UV. If I cut off all of my correlators, if I sequester them between a UV sector and an IR sector, perturbation theory still works perfectly fine as long as I'm only treating UV modes, which is also to say that it's only in the case where all of the modes in my diagram are infrared that I get my large support for doing any sort of correlator calculation. So let me first say that only the IR is experiencing interactions at all to see more explicitly why this is the case. If we were to compute, again, I said the space-time is creating particles as it expands. So I can ask, what is the particle number density at any given time, say for a given mode? And what one sees is that, so this is for just took k commoving to be 1, which means that So this is one co-moving mode, which means that as time goes forward, the mode is redshifting. Okay. Once it gets past -1, the physical mode is now larger than inverse Hubble. So what we see is that as the mode redshifts away to zero, you get this interesting sort of resonance of particle creation as it gets around the scale of Hubble. But then we see that there is this enormous production of particles as the mode gets softer and softer. Okay, and again, this sort of Hubble resonance, it's large, but then it dissipates under the subsequent inflation. But this particle production only increases, and it diverges. It diverges as 1/8a³ in the limit of the future. And so what dominates all of our two-point functions, which are all of the pieces that we're plugging into any sort of diagrammatic expansion, is precisely this huge particle number regime, which is the IR limit of the theory. You need to be significantly below Hubble, and that's where everything is dominated. So that's why in any diagram, it's the all IR sector, which is going to give the largest contribution. So let me think about how I might evolve a theory in the presence of these, in the presence of this non-perturbative interaction. So I can write down an evolution equation for the wave functional. Given the wave functional at some earlier time, I can compute it at some later time by integrating over initial configurations, over the field traveling between the two times, and then appropriately weighted by e to the is, and I will go ahead and write my e to the is in terms of an all soft, a mixed, and an all hard sector. Okay. So as I was saying, the UV interactions we can continue to treat perturbatively. And so just as a leading approximation, I'm even going to take the ultraviolet to be a free theory. Okay, and then I just have for the ultraviolet my usual Bunch-Davies wave functional. And remember, the Bunch-Davies wave functional was sort of, it was multiplicatively factorized in wave number. And so I can just pull that out for the UV. That means I've removed any interactions involving hard modes and also the mixed interactions. And I'm just left with my soft evolution. Okay. Now there's one more fact I need in order to evolve my wave functional, which is that classical equations of motion are second order. But for my wave functional, I really just want to do a first order evolution. I just want to know the field, given the field at a given time, what can I say about the distribution at a later time? And so to be able to make that statement, I need the additional fact that not only is the IR classical, but it's approximately first order. And I can quantify that in the following way, if I were to take, again, in the UV, I'm taking my theory to be perturbative, which in the leading approximation for perturbative is free. So I know my distribution in the UV. It's just the Bunch-Davies distribution. And so I can ask, given the distribution of the field, and alternatively the field conjugate momentum, which is also the field velocity, right? For a given classical system, if I know, you know, x and x dot at a given time, I can predict it at a later time. So I know the distributions of both of those as a quantum statement in the UV. And so I can just ask, if I take my field, what I want to say is that I can take the statement that the field has no field velocity, that's where the distribution is peaked, and solve for the subsequent evolution of the field. Or I can compare that to, well, let me give the field the RMS field velocity, and how much of a mistake do I make? And you see that if I say I evolve the theory exactly up until where the mode is at order Hubble, then I make this sort of 10%-ish level mistake comparing, you know, having zero field velocity and the RMS value. Of course, most of the support for the field is going to be is going to have a smaller error than this. And I can also say that, well, I just evolved my I exactly evolve my field to a bit past Hubble, and this number will decrease even more. Now, this is a free theory statement, but I can ask, well, at what point, you know, this is the mistake one makes if after after crossing the Hubble scale, one says it's first order evolution. But you see that the time scale of when you have to take into account of the potential is this much larger factor compared to Hubble. It's an order of magnitude past Hubble, or alternatively, there's the coupling is parametrically making you much larger than Hubble. And so yes, we have a potential that we have to take into account non-perturbatively, but the theory is already has already gone to this first order dominated regime before it.
Why is it first order? Is it first order because the RMS is sort of parametrically smaller? Or
it's first order because, I mean, physically it's this, right? You know that there's Hubble friction. And so as the mode exits the horizon, its acceleration drops away and it freezes. Okay. So now we're saying that after it freezes, a parametrically long time after it freezes, it becomes sensitive to, you know, that there's some tilt, there's some potential in the theory. And again, I can take, you know, yes, the theory becomes non-perturbative, but I can still take my lambda to be quite small. I can imagine it's some very slight tilt. And so it only becomes aware of this, say, slight tilt, say two orders of magnitude after the point at which it's gone over to just drifting in some terminal velocity. So this is going to change the drift of its terminal velocity, but it's not going to reintroduce large accelerations unless I were to say, of course, if I were to take lambda to be enormous, if I were to say, oh, it senses some, you know, huge interaction.
Right.
Then the argument.
Sorry, at zero order, you're just saying that the Hubble friction term, which is first order and time derivative, is much bigger than the second time, two time derivative.
Right.
And that you're solving a different differential equation for phi dot when you plug in a potential.
Right.
But it's still basically dominated by phi dot.
It's phi dot, and so you can show that if when you introduce the potential with phi dot, you don't reintroduce the acceleration. That phi dot is always coming in effectively by extra powers of the interaction. In fact, if you wanted to, you could reintroduce the phi dot behavior perturbatively, but it would just come into solving, effectively you'd be solving a first order equation with a slightly shifted potential. So the information is there and can be reintroduced, but unless your potential is enormous, you don't re-enter a second order regime.
Okay.
So with this last piece, we can finally time evolve the wave functional. So now that our classical equation of motion is first order, once I tell you phi at one time, you know what the phi has to be at some additional time, just based on the classical evolution. This delta function here is in quotes because I've written this as the wave functional. One only gets a delta function when one takes the mod square of the wave functional. It's the probability that is delta function sensitive to the classical evolution. And then, again, we have, for the infrared, if I ask about what is the infrared at some t plus delta t given information at t, so I account for the classical evolution, I have whatever my initial distribution was, I have my e to the is classical, and then I also have to account for the fact that however I've drawn my border between UV and IR, some slice of UV modes has crossed that border just by virtue of the continual redshifting of modes in De Sitter. And so as I update my infrared wave function, I also have to include some extra slice of UV modes, which again, I'm saying that I'm saying this delta t is small enough that I'm going to continue to treat them perturbatively or free, and so I'm just drawing them from the bunch Davies distribution. So having factored out the IR to make contact with the statement of Starobinsky looked at probability distributions over Hubble-patched sized averaging of values of the field. So I can take my, this is a complete but approximate quantum wave functional mod squared. So let me do this averaging by just doing a functional integral with this constraint. And now given everything I know about this psi mod squared, I can evolve this P, and I recover exactly Starobinsky's evolution equation for P, which is a famous Fokker-Planck equation. So just to unpack these two terms, if I were to cross off this term, I would just be left with a diffusion equation. It would be exactly this random walk, this Hubble-sized random walk that we saw earlier from just the two-point function. The ultimate origin of this term is this fact that modes are continually redshifting in from the UV. But of course, we also have our interactions, which we worked so hard to treat non-perturbatively, and they're giving us this drift term, that this distribution isn't just sensitive to diffusion from the UV, but also to the force of, that the field feels in the ion. And so one needs to take into account both terms. Now, there's an interesting literature on solving equations of this form. It's a linear PDE. What one finds is one can recast the Fokker-Planck equation into a Schrödinger equation, but with a Euclidean time. And so the solutions of P have this sort of Schrödinger equation-like behavior, but where the exponents go like minus gamma t instead of minus IET. And what's interesting is one can also show that these gamma n are positive definite, okay, and that there's always a zero mode, provided certain integrability conditions or normalizability conditions of the potential. And so this was the statement I was making earlier. All of my details are going to wind up in these gamma and these phi n's, and they're going to get exponentially washed out in the future. And so that all that's left in the arbitrary future, if you wanted to compute correlators for the infrared sector of this theory, is this exponential determined by the potential. Okay. So as I go to the infinite future, I find that my very pathological series of diverging diagrams for, say, the two-point function actually goes to this form, okay, which has this very non-perturbative looking 1 over square root coupling in the denominator. And of course, we see that in the limit that we turn off interactions and we go back to the free theory, we get a divergence in the infinite future, which was exactly what we saw from the direct free theory calculation. Okay. So I started with a lot of highfalutin talk about holography. So given the work we've done to understand this wave functional picture of stochastic inflation, the sort of hints we're being led to for holography, which at the moment are just hints, are that we're seeing that De Sitter contains within it a parton shower-like dynamics. And what I mean by that is that in both cases, we start with fully quantum systems, whether it's De Sitter field theory or whether it's QCD. But in both cases, we can describe the dominant behavior. In De Sitter, it's the dominant late-time behavior. In QCD, it's some leading log approximation. Just in terms of probabilities, that we were able to work with wave functional mod squareds and could throw out phase information. In both cases, these probabilities are flowing. In QCD, it's the DGLAP evolution with renormalization scale. For De Sitter, it's our Fokker-Planck evolution. And very interestingly, unlike QCD, we're flowing to a fixed point in De Sitter, right? The probability distribution is being led to some attractor solution. So we also have a notion of factorization. In De Sitter, it's this very sort of strict causal factorization into Hubble patches. Maybe computing correlators in a particular patch is analogous to some sort of jet statement in QCD, that there's certain leading properties of jets that you only need that are independent of what else is going on in the event. Okay. So at the moment, these are just suggestions, but it's where we're heading with this work, is to try to understand what is the jet physics of this dual theory that's giving us these properties which are which are reminding us of QCD. So, thank you.
Do we have any other questions?
Yes.
So, what you showed is that the subleading behavior has e to the minus gamma. You're saying that that means that the dependence, for example, on beta disappears. But that won't be true, for example, if one of the energy modes also goes down to zero when in the limit of beta goes to zero.
One of the, what's the energy?
How do you know that all the, I guess the question is, how do you know that all of your gammas are positive rather than positive semi-energy?
Correct.
But there can't be a zero.
In particular, the limit when beta goes to zero, your regularization exponent, right? How do you know that gamma doesn't go there?
Oh, you're saying, right, if I take, yeah. You're just saying the contained in here has to be the fact that a zero value of beta would restore the pathology of the theory.
Right.
So.
Unless what you're saying is that lambda is itself a regulator of a certain.
Lambda?
The 5-4 coupling constant.
Right.
That was one way you could interpret this behavior. Yeah.
Hmm.
I don't know. Is that a sensible interpretation?
Right, I mean, physically what I think is going on, is the following. You have this Hubble patch random walk, okay? And if there were no potential, large field value doesn't mean anything, right? It's a massless theory. So you can random walk off to infinity, it costs you nothing. Here you turn on the slightest potential and, eventually you wander so far that you're paying enormous energy costs. And of course, to sitter, it violates the conservation of energy, but it can only violate it by sort of order Hubble amounts. And so once you start asking it to give you a lot more energy than order Hubble, it can't support that. So in that sense, lambda is a regulator on phi squared. But I think it's an interesting question, though, Itai, whether, because I haven't done the exercise of putting in a finite beta and seeing how that would affect, say, the first. So I don't know. So, I don't concretely know whether it's only, beta can take whatever value and it will forget it. But that if it becomes arbitrarily close to zero, this sort of turns off arbitrarily slowly with time, or whether or not the dependence is more mild. And that once I regulated it and I set this up, then it's just the interaction that's doing the work, and the theory could have propagated for an infinite amount of time. I would suspect that's the case, because this physical picture of just the potential keeps you from wandering arbitrarily far should hold. But again, maybe if you let an infinite amount of time pass, you get to this state sort of for any finite time. Because this t is still counting from the start of inflation, which is tied to what you put in for beta. So if I were to take the start of inflation to the arbitrarily far past, then, these will already all be zero. So I guess I'm thinking in real time here, but it does seem to be important that you're starting inflation at a finite time in order to talk about this expression.
Any other questions?
Yeah. I just wonder, have you found that in ADS, you also have this holography along the time directory?
Yeah, I think people would rather not think about holography along time-like directions, so I don't know of anyone that's... I mean, people work people work hard to map the sitter into ADS or maybe even a Euclidean ADS. So they try to take time out of the system as much as they can. So I don't know if people trying to go the other way and specifically treat the time in ADS.
All right, we asked a lot of questions during the talk, so let's thank you.